Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. We are back to continue and really conclude our coverage of The Brotherhood of Mutilation by Brian Evanson. This is a novella that was originally published in 2003. Because it's a novella, because it's really long, we have devoted two episodes to this story. We've done the recap already, and so this episode is the discussion.
We should also say, again, that this episode was commissioned to us, and boy, we rely on commissioned episodes so much, and so we hope we're doing this story a fair service. We both, I think, loved it, and I think what made me love it was thinking about it and reflecting on it, which I hope we'll be able to get across in this discussion. So thank you so much to our generous supporter who commissioned this story for us.
Yes, again, thank you so very much. Commissions are a huge part of how the network stays on the air. It's also a huge part of how we get to read extra stuff, stuff that we might not have read otherwise. And I think that probably is the case with this one. But wow, yeah, I am very glad that we got to read this. Well, Brandon, last time in the recap episode, you laid some hints about how you wanted to look at this story. So I am eager to get started.
Yeah, I think that the Brotherhood of Mutilation is the sort of story that can be approached in so many different ways. You know, if you like weird premises and gore and grime, this story's for you. If you like detective crime fiction, this story's also for you. And if you only show up for Swiftian satire, you know, the technique that comes, is named primarily from Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal, where the writer is writing about something exceedingly dark, but keeping a steady tone throughout. Also, you have to be satirizing something. If you like that sort of thing, this story has a heavy dose of that too. So ultimately, I feel like it's the type of story that really rewards thinking about in these different ways, because even if some audiences might find the content of this story or what jumped out to them as the content of the story as distasteful to them, there's another way in that might help ease that discomfort, that encounter with the more difficult elements of the text. So that's what I want to do. I want to find this a way in to make everybody enjoy this story as much as I did. Not so that we're taking the teeth out of the story or taking its edge off, but I guess just to look at its teeth and decide what we should do with them. So we're going to talk about this story as a bit of crime writing or detective fiction. We're going to talk about it as a horror story, and then we'll finally talk about it as a bit of Swiftian satire. So first, let's approach this story as a detective story. Glenn, what are the elements you see Evanson putting into play that gives this novella what is, in my opinion, its backbone, its spine?
Yes, I mean, all of the plot beats really are detective story plot beats. The characters also are detective story characters, and the setting is also very detective story, though in different ways, right? Some of this is hard-boiled, some of it is other types of detective fiction as well. But the biggest thing, of course, is that our protagonist, Klein, is some kind of police cop. It's not entirely clear how, you know, in what way, but it does seem like he was an undercover detective, that he was an infiltrator, probably involved in narcotics or something like that. You know, it's not entirely clear. I mean, maybe it was even terrorism, I guess, given that this was published in 2003 and you already made some comparisons with Jack Bauer. So perhaps that's what he was doing. But he's some kind of law enforcement officer, someone who doesn't necessarily investigate, as he says in the story, but infiltrates. And so that's really what he's doing here, right? He comes in, is a member of this organization for a little while, and is just trying to make sense of it, to figure out what's going on, who's really in charge, what people's agendas are, and so on. So that's really the big thing that we get for this being a detective story. But then we get, as we talked about, we get the goons who are, you know, I guess they are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, as you said last time, but they also are straight out of just about every hard-boiled detective story that I've ever read, the gentleman goons. And of course, then we've also got some seediness in this story that makes it feel hard-boiled. There's a lot of drinking, and then also there's this strip club. And so that gives it, I think, a real hard-boiled sense as well. So just even those three things, there are more things we could talk about, but just even those three things then give this story at least the skin of a detective story.
It certainly does have the skin of a detective story, but Klein is hardly a detective. He's smart, but he's not really Sherlock Holmesing anything out there in the world. The closest he comes to that is realizing that blood should dry quicker than it does, and then he makes great intuitive leaps that we see. You know, he's at least as good a detective as Tom Cruise's character in Eyes Wide Shut. You know, but I wonder then, Glenn, you know, you might have something to say about Klein's detective skills, but I'm really more interested in what you thought his hard-boiled is giving away the goose here a little bit, but what his trope detective profile is in this story. Like, to if you were going to pitch this and have someone buy into it as someone who likes detective fiction, what sort of detective is Klein?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question, because I obviously just leaned right into thinking about hard boiled, which if you say detective, I say hard boiled, even though I love cozies as well. And some of the other types of detective stories we get also, like police procedurals. But you're absolutely right. Klein is neither of those things. There's no real crime scene investigation happening here. I mean, we get like a little bit of that, but Klein is not here to look at physical clues and know things about him, right? He's not looking at a stain and recognizing that it's a particular type of mustard that you can only get at one specific shop in one specific neighborhood in London, and that therefore that sends him, you know, down the thought that is going to get him to the criminal. There's nothing like that happening here. It is hard-boiled in the sense that the detective's job is to get in the thick of it, get beat up a lot, and then while recovering from being beat up slash being drunk a little bit, make sense of everything that he's encountered and discover that it's probably too late to do anything about it, right? That's the type of story we're in here, where the detective is not really the protagonist of the story, which is so often the case, I think, in cozy mysteries like Sherlock Holmes or Murder, She Wrote. This is really the antagonist is, in fact, the protagonist of the story, right? This is Borchers' story. We're just getting it through Klein's lens. And that's a real hallmark of what writers like Hammett and Chandler do. I haven't actually answered your question about how I would pitch this, but that's my elaboration on what I mean here.
That's a brilliant answer. I think that's absolutely right. He's the tough guy detective, right? He's the guy whose epiphany feels like a hangover more than anything else. And it's not something that gets you out of the world that he's gotten deep into, but it's deeper in. The detective is worse off for having been introduced to the crime and being asked to solve it than he was when the story started, you know. And that's something we talked a little bit about is, you know, Klein as a detective, as a man in this story, he starts out in a really bad place. Do you think he's ends up in a worse place at the end of the story?
Yeah, this is a great question, but I think maybe we should preface this by revealing to each other and to the audience whether or not we continued on in this book and read the novel Last Days, which is a sequel to this story. I did not. Did you read it?
No, I really wanted to, but we've got a little stack of books that we have to get through for the show. So I just didn't feel like I had the time, though I was very tempted to, because I wanted to read another 100 pages in an hour and feel great about that.
Yes, I had a suspicion, actually, that you were going to. I think that if you had gotten your copy of the book 2 days before you actually did, you might have done it. But I intentionally did not read it, although it's like literally what I'm going to do tonight, because I want to know the answer to what does happen next. You know, is Klein better off? What's going to be his story? But just taking this story as a standalone story, as it was for, I guess, 15 years or close to 15 years, a dozen years at least, separates the novella from the novel that are now packaged together in this volume, Last Days, that has this introduction by Peter Straub. This is a whole thing published by Coffee House Press. At any rate, to answer your question, Brandon, he starts off this story in a very dark place, gets a little bit darker as we get more into the backstory, and he is suffering so heavily from depression that he is not getting out of bed and seems like he is actually near death. His body is shutting down because he's not been feeding himself because of the deepness of this depression that he's suffering from in the aftermath of going through this traumatic experience, trying to adjust to not having a limb, also not having any sort of community to be in. He's been discharged from his job, but his job also was not a job that let him have any coworkers, like real coworkers, because his job was to pretend to be someone he's not and hang out with people that he's investigating and trying to get arrested. And so he's utterly alone. And so then his trajectory in this story is that he is in a community with people who, in some sense, are like him. He's drinking with people and spending time with them. Goose actually really seems to think of Klein as a kind of friend, at least a little bit. And he's up. We see him eating in, you know, quite a bit, actually, in this story. He's interested in sex in some way. He looks at the softcore porn calendars. He goes to the strip club. He seems to be more alive than he was at the beginning. Yet he's a party to criminal acts here in some sense, and his body, if not necessarily his life, is in pretty immediate jeopardy right when this story ends. So there is some sense, I think, in which he's better off than he was at the beginning, but the question maybe is at what price? And then the other question is, but what happens on the next page?
Right. And all of that, I think, really lends itself to the satirical portion, the satirical aspect of this novella, which Evanson could be asking a question like, is it really true that any community is better than no community? Is it true that any religion is better than no religion? You know, any faith system is better than no faith system? And really getting us to a point where Klein is living through his nightmare, and then we have to wonder whether or not this novel, whether or not Klein's characters is Klein is going to circle back on himself as a character, whether this second amputation really is going to be the beginning of life, or whether it's going to be, as we see Klein at the beginning of the novel, the start of another slow death. And we just don't know. It's a brilliant ending to the story.
So before we move on in your questions, Brandon, I think, you know, given that we both are likely to go read this on our own, we won't, I don't think, have time to do an episode on it, but we'll probably end up reading the novel on our own and talking about it off mic. What is your prediction about what's going to happen next? Like, what happens to Klein in the novel, do you think?
My prediction is that Klein isn't going to be able to resist having even a purpose such as this. And I think he's going to find his way into the Brotherhood. I mean, I could use this to transition to our next section, but I'm really interested in your answer here before we move on.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I do think he's going to chop off his arm, and that's going to go just fine. Precisely what happens in the next paragraph after that, I don't quite know, but my expectation is that the novel, Last Days, is about not just how Klein finds his way into the Brotherhood, but how he finds himself at the top of the Brotherhood.
Right, because I think you're picking up on something that maybe ties into the horror aspect of the novel a little bit, which is this chosen one narrative in the background where, you know, the self-cauterization is maybe the cause for a certain type of schismatic to take place. And the way that that is very important to Borchers gives us the sense that Klein is this chosen one. Because I'd classify the subgenre of horror here maybe as religious horror if I was forced to. Though, Glenn, I think you had a different sense of what the horror was at the forefront of the story. So what sense of horror did you pick up on? What subgenre maybe of horror did you pick up on as feeling the strongest to you when you were reading this novella?
Well, for me, it was definitely body horror. But to be honest, you know, I'm so squeamish about body stuff that any story that even just has somebody smashing their finger in a door, I'm like, that's body horror and I'm out, you know? So that definitely is what it felt like to me. Although I will say that I do not care for body horror, and usually do hit the eject button pretty quickly as soon as there's something squeamish on the page. This, I just absolutely captivated me. But somehow what is being done to bodies in this story is really, really disturbing. Evanson's writing about it was not disturbing, right? There was nothing extraordinarily graphic about the descriptions of the violence. It didn't linger on that. And what was actually more horrifying to me was the Kafkaesque nightmare of being trapped in this situation. And so I just thought this was absolutely brilliant from Evanson. So again, I think, you know, there's a kind of body horror skin on this, but actually the thing that really unsettled me was not that, it was something else.
Yeah, I think Evanson is really tying into ritualistic religions. He, and also, I mean, body horror and religious horror work really well together if you want them to, especially if you're coming from a Christian background. Evanson has a Mormon background. He was pretty deep into Mormonism, though I don't know where he stands with regard to that now. But anyway, the reason why body horror and religious horror, I think, work so well together, especially from a Christian perspective, isn't just the rituals and the way horror writers have always loved to play with that sort of thing, but the crucifixion of Christ relies upon a certain fixation with bodily torment. And I think that Evanson is playing with that a little bit here. The epigram that he chose for the story is from an instruction spoken by Christ that in context is about taking total responsibility for one's missing the mark with regard to moral action or transgressing certain virtue calls, rather than laying the blame on others. So this bit about the eye is about lust, the bit about the hand, maybe it's also about lust, could be about a lot of other things. But Christ's language in this part of the Sermon on the Mount is so strong that one could easily understand how looking at these verses in the context of a Christianity that requires us to gaze upon a mutilated, tortured man on a cross could lead to the development of a cult that is really into bodily mutilation, that is clearly also well-versed in Christian texts.
Right. I mean, this is at the core of quite a bit of ancient and medieval Christianity. As you said, Christianity's God dies, is tortured to death on this Roman torture device, the cross, right? This is what the crucifixion is. And in different times and different places in the history of Christianity, different Christian groups have really emphasized the physical suffering of Christ on the cross, also the suffering of having to carry the cross up the hill and the torment of being mocked as he goes, and all of really emphasize the suffering of that. And then there also are strands of Christianity throughout its history that have located sin in the body, right? Located sin as being something of the body, that, you know, gluttony and lust are things in which we're indulging our body and so on. And so the way to fight sin, the way to fight evil is to deny our body those things, not even just to keep it at neutral, but to be negative, right? So to actively starve yourself, to, in fact, sometimes even tempt yourself with sex so that you can be actively resisting it. Something that's really prominent in the response to the Black Death in the 14th century is the rise of flagellants, which is to say people who are flagellating themselves, whipping themselves to punish themselves for the wickedness in society that led God to send the Black Death to Western Europe. So yeah, this is something that we find throughout Christianity, and it is hard not to read this story, to understand this organization as some kind of Christian sect, even though there's nothing explicit about that. We don't get anything really about doctrine in this organization. Nonetheless, it still feels like it is some kind of Christian organization.
I think part also of what makes us feel so unsettled by this cult, you know, it's not only the fact that the cult provides so much of the unsettling imagery that we find in this story. It's that they don't seem to be cutting off body parts in accord with Christ's words that we get for the epigram. They're not doing it because of some kind of sin or transgression. I use the phrase missing the mark. I think I prefer that to sin. I think it makes more sense. It makes Christianity somehow more coherent to think of sin as the archery term instead of what kind of cultural weight it has on it. But this group doesn't seem to be doing anything. We don't know what their transgressions are or in what ways they miss the mark as practitioners of this religion. What they seem to be doing is ritualistically climbing the hierarchy ladder within the Brotherhood. And I really wonder what you made of this, Glenn. Certainly it serves the horror of this story, but on the religious side of the story, if this wasn't just so steeped in horror imagery, how would you begin to piece together what sort of spiritual wholeness or perfection these dudes are going for?
Yeah, we don't see a lot of ritual practice, actually, in this story. The only ritual practice we really see is the amputations, and that doesn't seem to happen with any kind of regularity, right? There's no rule about when this happens. It happens once a week, or someone gets amputated, or when you've been here for X number of days or months or years, you get an amputation and there's a celebration for the group or something like that. There's no sense that there are daily rituals that this group is participating in. So one thing that Christian monks do in late antiquity and the Middle Ages, and actually today still as well, is to have prayers throughout the day, and different orders of monks will do this differently, but usually it involves not getting a full night's sleep. This is part of the bodily abnegation of this, is you should deprive yourself of sleep because you should be, your body exists to suffer, and so you should inflict some suffering on it. And so you get up at different times in the middle of the night, or you stay up too late, or you get up very early in order to pray, for example, right? And there are different names for these different prayers at the different times of the day and so on. But we don't see anything like that in this organization either. We don't see community meals. We don't see community work. We do see parties, but the party is kind of a private party where Goose has invited some people, but not everybody. So it's, you know, it's not a grade school birthday party where you have to invite the entire class, or you can't invite anybody at all either. So yeah, it's hard to see an angle into understanding what this religion does. I think we have a lot more about what it believes, or at least what it's interested in. But the only really, I guess, ritualistic thing that we see, or community-minded, community-oriented thing we see, is that they are all wearing the same clothes.
Yeah, that's about it. They also all look at the same pornography, I guess, right? Or the same smut, which is such a better word. But yeah, it's so strange. This organization that also requires there to be so many guards on the compound. And I guess there's also this rigid hierarchy. And so what role do you think these guards played? Like, who would volunteer to get an eye removed, maybe be castrated? It's another bit of like Shakespearean humor, if you are into that sort of thing, where eyeballs and balls are kind of the same and euphemistically interchangeable. But do you think the guards are just here to keep people out, keep people in, and keep a two from talking to an eight? Like, what are the guards doing here?
Well, I do think that these are all of their jobs. Certainly, it feels like they are here at the beginning to keep people out of this compound, right? It is definitely a compound. It's got walls. There are different buildings inside. And what is going on here is that people are being subjected to amputations, willingly, at least on the surface, right? That people here would say that they are here by choice. But this definitely feels like at least some of the people have been coerced into being here. They've been brainwashed, for lack of a better term, right? That these people have families who might be looking for them, trying to get them back. And so I think that that's probably the biggest reason that the guards are here. But then, yes, also the guards are here, I think, to keep people in, because this Brotherhood wants to remain unknown by the outside world. And so I don't think that you can live here for 3 years and then decide, actually, you know what, I think I'd actually just rather go be a Lutheran and move back home. I don't think that's an option that you have. And so that's another reason the guards are here. And then, yeah, as you say, the guards also clearly are here to enforce the hierarchy. I don't know that other than Klein, there's a lot of call for use of violence to enforce that. And so in that sense, it's a little more pomp and circumstance, right? That if you're important, you get guards outside your building, and that's part of what's going on there. But the guards also then do seem to be you know, an organization within the organization that has its own system of prestige. And I think managing a system of prestige is a big part of what the leaders of this organization are doing, right? This is what the rank system is. You know, you're a 2 versus an 8 versus a 12. It kind of badges of honor. Do you get a party? Do you get scotch from Borcher? How much scotch do you get? Do you get to cut off one of his limbs? Right, that there's a real sense in which what Borcher and Aline and perhaps some of the other higher ups, Andreessen, I guess maybe as well, are doing is bestowing tokens of prestige and affection on people, and having the guards track is one way that you can do that for people.
I wonder if Evanson is commenting on his experience of the hierarchical system within the Mormon church, which I don't know enough about. And I wonder if Evanson is writing in some sense satirically about his experience as a practitioner of Mormonism and some of the ways that the power and hierarchy play out in that religion that you also see in the Catholic Church and in certain small communities of non-denominational Christianity and other pockets of Christianity as well. So I think that Evanson is playing with that a little bit, but you mentioned the people at the top of the pyramid here. And I want to talk about Aline's role as a prophet of this terrible religion. The first question I have for you is, how can someone without a tongue and also without butt cheeks be a prophet? You know, like, what does Aline prophesy about?
Here again, we don't know the history of this organization, but presumably Aline is the first, right? He's the founder of this organization. He was the first one to hear the call, heed the call, and then draw others to him. Presumably, the drawing others to him didn't start once he had removed his own tongue or had someone remove his tongue for him, right? That started before that point. So maybe this started after he had amputated one thing. He started telling people about it and they got interested in his views on this and decided to join him. It is hard to understand how this religion would get started, right? How Aline gets followers. But I think that we have to believe that it started a long time ago, and Borcher presumably was the first follower or among the first followers. And it does seem like this has been going on long enough that there's a clear gap between the people at the top, such as Aline and Borcher, and people like Goose, who are new to this, that there are now sort of generations of practitioners in this compound, and that this has grown exponentially and is a thriving and growing religion.
You really get the sense that somebody like Aline, maybe Andreessen, people like that, people at the top, once did this practice to cut off the offending limb, right? As Jesus suggests in the Sermon on the Mount, and that it started out as this truly devout spiritual practice. But now we're at the point, you know, where Goose and Ramsey are arguing about, well, if you cut off a hand, why is that a 1? When if you cut off a finger, that's also a 1. So why shouldn't a hand be a 6? And if you can cut off each finger and get those counted and, you know, getting into all this, you know, Thomistic arguing how many angels can fit on the head of a pin sort of thing, where we get into the more satirical side of this, of what Evanson is satirizing, where Borcher recognizes that that's where the people are in this practice. They are arguing about angels dancing on the head of a pin instead of actually cutting off offended body parts. They're having parties and drinking when they're doing this practice. This is something you see, I think, Paul in the letter to the Colossians or the Ephesians saying, hey, don't get drunk at communion. That's not what it's for. You know, and so, right, you get this sense of Evanson looking at the development of Christianity into a series of arguments about weird metaphysical topics instead of a moral practice. And that is taking place here in as we see the development of this religion in this story.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this argument at the beginning about, you know, how should we be counting how many amputations people have had? Maybe it should be a point system, you know, for different types of amputations. We should weigh the thing that's been amputated and tally it that way. But, you know, what people have come in different sizes, so their amputated parts are going to weigh differently. You know, one person's arm is going to weigh different than another person's arm. I really, really enjoyed that discussion in the car. And you're right, it does feel very much like conversations that people in Christianity have, especially in, you know, my area of expertise on Christianity in late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, where, you know, people are arguing about all sorts of things and can become schismatic over them. Things that to an outsider seem so trivial, like we all agree on exactly what prayers we should say in our worship service, but we totally disagree on the order of them. And we can't coexist. We can't be in the same organization because they want to put, you know, the second prayer third, and I want to put it second, you know, and it just, we can't exist together. There's no harmony there. And that's a real thing that's going on in the history of Christianity. And Evanson has, I think, nailed that here. And yeah, it feels satirical, but also feels serious at the same time.
Well, it's that kind of Swiftian satire, right? Where he's approaching this topic by being biting and dark and very real, as if it was a real argument. But the absurdity, you can't help but to notice the absurdity. And we not only see this kind of use of Swiftian satire in these Goose and Ramsay discussions, in Borchert's aims in eliminating Aline and making Aline a martyr, maybe to re-solidify the group around him to avoid a schism, but we also see it in the use of visuals surrounding the amputated women as sexual objects or fetishes, but also as a reference to the Swift poem where that titular nymph removes her eyes or hair, her limbs, once she gets home in order to go to bed. And we see that sense of relief that is part of the humor of Swift's poem be experienced by Goose and Ramsay when they can remove their limbs in the car. I don't want to get into whether or not Swift had a problem with women or maybe with artificial constructs of beauty. That's not what we're here to discuss. Also, maybe Swift was disgusted by them. I'm not sure. But you know, I've been pushing this really hard, this concept, the way that this story can be read as a Swiftian satire, that I haven't really stopped to ask you if you encountered this story in this way at all when you were reading it.
Well, it definitely feels like satire, right? I mean, a religion that is predicated on chopping off your own limbs and making sure you're all wearing the same red clip-on ties, but then also has seemingly at the center of it, working in the porn industry and also just going to the strip club that you have within your religious compound, it's hard not to see immediately that something satirical is going on here.
Yeah, I mean, Evanson has to be looking at some hypocrisy he might have encountered. I think something that we all see, especially when it shows up in the news of Christian elders who are supposed to be seeking or leading people towards some kind of spiritual or moral purity, getting caught up in the hypocrisy usually of some kind of sexual deviancy. Evanson's eliminated that and saying, hey, it's actually just part of the religion. It's one of the same. It's two sides of the same coin here, right? And pointing to the satire there, that we could, to the point where, as we've talked about, wondering what even spiritual or moral heights this organization is even going for. But I think what Evanson is really satirizing here is schismatics, the cutting off of members of the body of a church who have disagreements about the order of prayer, for instance, or whether or not self-cauterization is more mystically spiritual than having somebody cauterize a wound for you. The different use of instruments in cutting people off or cutting a body part off and what that's for. This is a story that at its heart is satirizing the way schisms function within religious orders, hierarchical religious orders in particular, and looking at how absurd that is from an outsider's perspective, but also the way the language is employed to talk about schisms in such a violent and strong way that it is like amputating body parts. I mean, that is literal language that's used in order for some people to maintain power and others to gain power within a religious order.
You mentioned at the top of that, Brandon, hypocrisy. And I'm wondering, what would actual hypocrisy look like in this organization, right? The things that you were referring to there, I think often are sexual in nature, right? Preachers who are preaching some kind of sexual abstinence or, you know, sexual fidelity, and then are caught not behaving in accordance with what they're preaching, right? Not doing what they say. What do you think that type of hypocrisy would actually look like in this organization? Like not getting as many amputations as you tell other people to, faking your amputations? What would that look like to you?
Yeah, I have no idea, right? Because Evanston has covered what is usually the core base, the core demonstration of hypocrisy, and kind of laid it flat and said, it's not hypocrisy. It's actually part of the pattern of a lot of religious leaders, especially ones who are seeking power through crowd control and renown and prestige. So, you know, there's actually no difference here between people who claim to be practicing some sort of ethical, spiritual norm, something that's going to get them to a spiritual height, and having some sort of deviancy in their background, in their character, as a flaw. They're one and the same. So I guess it would have to be around the way that people practice their amputations. And that's why Klein presents such a danger, because for some reason this organization has convinced themselves that Klein has willed himself to become amputated because he needed to be amputated in order to escape his situation, that this deadly situation he was in. And so maybe the hypocrisy has something to do with the will behind the amputation. And another reason why Klein is a danger is because he claims to have not willed it. Something along those lines. I'm not articulating it well, but people who are listening who can complete my work here can probably articulate it better than I am now.
Well, it is difficult to see what it would be, right? Because we don't actually get any sense of moral preaching in this organization, where a lot of Christianity's bodily abnegation is just that. It's abnegation. It's denying your body things that your body craves. Food and sex are the two big ones, but those are not things that are being denied here. There doesn't seem to be any particular emphasis on damaging the parts of your bodies that would engage in those activities or want to engage in those activities. Some people have, but there doesn't seem to be an emphasis on that. That's not what is calling people here. And in fact, lust is not simply the business of this organization. It's not simply how the organization funds itself. It is also here as really the only pastime that we see. So there is simply no code of behavior that we see being preached or even just discussed in this organization. It just seems like this is a group where if you feel like having somebody chop off your hand or poke out your eye, you can do that here, and then you can have some drinks with like-minded people. So it's a strange religion in that sense. It has all this, the trappings of a religion, but it doesn't seem to have a lot of the substance of it.
Right. I think they're trying to get to some state of using shock as a replacement for some kind of spiritual enlightenment. But that's insane. I think the humor lies in the way Evanston threads the concern about schisms and schismatics into the story. And if you know about the history of Christianity, the way Christ talks about his people as a body, the way people are being cast out, all that language of chopping off limbs, Evanston is trying to build, I think, here a satire on some level around that type of language and saying, okay, well, what if we took this language seriously and looked at what people who really way over-identified with this language, what would they do? And would it become about the big end of the egg or the little end of the egg? Or would they be able to find themselves adhering to some kind of moral practice? Or is this religion really just all about power and hierarchy?
We should say, too, that one of the ways that this religion flies in the face of mainline Christianity is that in Christianity, human bodies are themselves sacred in some way. And in early Christianity, and still lingering into late antique Christianity as well, a big part of the discourse, something that led to schisms within the organization or organizations, I should say, was a question of whether or not the afterlife was going to take place in your real physical body that you have now on earth, or if it was going to be spiritual in some nature. But just about every type of Christianity that was being practiced in the first five centuries of the religion believed that human bodies should not be damaged, and that to damage a person's body was really a crime against that person's soul as much as it was a crime against that person's body. And one of the ways actually that we see this is in Constantine's laws. Constantine, the first Christian Roman emperor who made issued a lot of legislation in which Christian practices were codified into law. And one of these is that it had been practiced throughout the Mediterranean world to either brand or tattoo slaves who had run away, so that they could be easily distinguished. The idea being that a slave who has run away once is more likely to be someone to try to run away again. So we're going to put a mark on this person such that they're easily identifiable. There's just not really going to be any way for them to run away and hide. And that mark had been a brand or a tattoo for centuries, all throughout the Mediterranean world. Constantine outlaws that practice and replaces this with collars. So you're going to put a metal, typically iron, collar on a slave who has run away once, that a collar that they cannot remove, that will be the thing that can identify them. And something that's always a question in legal history is whether or not laws were really enforced. To what extent were they actually put into practice? Is the law descriptive or is it prescriptive? But in this case, archaeology supports that this was a law that had a profound social effect. We suddenly, from the 4th century on, find a lot of these collars, and we lose sight in art history of slaves with these types of marks on them and so on. So this is just one example in which Christianity really thinks about the sanctity of the body and protecting even the bodies of slaves, even from just being marked in some way, because we're going to need these bodies in the afterlife. This is what we're going to have. Evanson obviously has completely flipped that on its head, where this isn't about denying your body things that it wants, because those things that the body wants is the place where sin is located, that those desires are the reasons we do horrible things to other people. It's having a body at all that seems to be wicked here, and that you need to be chopping off parts of your body if you're going to be closer to the divine. And so this is a place where, although a lot of this feels very Christian, this feels really completely the antithesis of what Christianity preaches about bodies.
There's even moments in the text where it might occur just twice throughout the text, but it's enough to leave an impact, that the ghost limb is somehow part of what Klein thinks these guys are trying to achieve. That spiritual sensation of having something that's not there is part of this spiritual practice. So I think that that's absolutely the case too, and even textually relevant and defensible as looking at Evanson's reversal of the holiness of the body or the sacredness of the body and saying, actually, what these guys are doing is trying to force the sensation of ghostliness, of the spirit being present through the removal, through the absence of the limbs. I mean, one thing I didn't point out here is just this conversation about present absence, absence, and absent presence, which is one way that biblical critics have looked at God's role in the church and in history, first as a presence, then as a present absence, where people were aware, felt God's absence as a presence, feeling, then as God's absence, which you see in the later prophets or in the early part of the New Testament before Christ's birth, and these kinds of stages of God working in history as it's narrated in the biblical texts. These are phrases that are found in the Brotherhood of Mutilation, and it's something that gives weight to the sense that this is some really weird offshoot of Christianity, and we certainly don't want to get involved in this practice at all.
Tangential to that, Brandon, there's another question I wanted to ask you, and this goes back to the episodes that we did on Evanson's other novella, or another Evanson novella, Dust, which we did on Patreon a few years ago now at this point. One of the things that we noticed there was names, and that a lot of the names in that story were Scandinavian in origin. And we spent some time in our discussion episode there trying to figure out what that meant, if it meant anything, what that might show us. You and I, off mic in the recap, had a little conversation about how we should be pronouncing the names in this story, and you let me win that argument where I wanted to pronounce them like they were French. Part of why I wanted to do that is I just had this sense that this was taking place in Louisiana, which is neither here nor there, or is it? I guess this is the question I'm getting to. A lot of these names are French sounding, and I wondered if you derived any meaning from that.
I didn't. The uniform is what kind of tipped me off of being this kind of Mormon missionary type of look to it. I don't think the red tie is part of the missionary outfit, but the gray pant, the gray slacks, the white short sleeve collared shirt. This to me had more of the feel of less of a place and more of the feeling of going to a training camp for missions work or something like that, some kind of compound where you're going to do role playing and you're going to get deeper into the organization and stuff like that. So I didn't, to me, the setting was, could have been any place. The short sleeves maybe indicate that it's warm, so Louisiana would make sense. The failing structures, an infrastructure of the compound, or what feels like a decrepit compound, also could be the Deep South, something we saw in, you know, Fifth Head of Cerberus with the kind of New Orleans vibe. I get where you're picking up on that. I just, you know, in reading it, I wanted to pronounce Borscher as Borker just because he's the bad guy and it's a harsher sounding phrase. But I think you're right to want to go with the French pronunciation there.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else about what that might mean. I think we were kind of stumped on this too in Dust, but I would love to hear if listeners have anything to say about that. Just another question here too on this line, Brandon, is where, not so much where, but what do you think this compound is? Is it a former missionary training camp? Is it a former summer camp? An abandoned military base? What do you think?
My guess is it feels more like a decommissioned military base. The housing feels like, you know, decommissioned military housing. Some of the places feel like barracks. It could be an old fort, you know, that was remodeled with the types of housing that you and I came across in training camps in the military. It's all aluminum and tin, you know, it just, or like wood cabins. It all felt very cheap and hastily built, but it kept the rain out. You know, and I guess that's what these guys were going for.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well. I did feel like it was a decommissioned military base or army post of some sort. You know, I've lived on one of those actually when I was in the military for strange and complicated reasons. But so I had the real sense that, yeah, this is a place that had been, you know, a military installation that had been decommissioned as the Cold War was winding down and ending. And part of that decommission process was that the facility or parts of the facility were sold to anyone who wanted to buy them, and that this church bought at least a segment of of this land, I guess with their smut money. And that's my headcanon, at least about what's going on here. But again, I would be interested in other hypotheses.
Yeah, the other half was purchased by the Guild of Witches. I only have kind of one more question to wrap up here. And it's something that, you know, I've been thinking about as we're thinking about approaches to this story. And I just wonder, I don't know, pick a person in your imagination, somebody who you think might enjoy the story, or actually it would be better, somebody who would really not want to read it based on one approach to it. Maybe it's the horror approach. Maybe it's the detective approach. How would you pitch this story to someone who might not like horror fiction? I guess that's the core question.
Yeah, I think I would go with the detective angle as a type of elevator pitch for this story, because I think that's going to have the biggest audience appeal, right? I mean, still the most popular TV shows are police procedurals or law shows, right? People really enjoy that stuff. So, and pitching it that way also gives you the mystery element, right? You can give a tease about what is the mystery here. And the mystery is actually, what is the mystery here? What has there even been a crime that needs to be investigated? And I think that that's something that someone who likes to read or watch mystery stories or detective stories might find as a way in, even if this is someone who doesn't normally like horror stories.
Yeah, I think I came in expecting this to be, because even off mic when you were like, yeah, we were doing a body horror story, you know, I was like, ugh, okay, are we going to read something really gruesome? Which I also don't love body horror, but this story was a cracking good tough guy detective story. And I was delighted to find so much Swiftian satire in it. I mean, truly. And so, yeah, I'd have a hard time pitching it as anything other than a kind of brutal satire of schisms. That's never a good thing to pitch people on, though. So I think we'd have to, yeah, stick with it, pitching it primarily as a detective story, and then let the delight unfold as the reader discovers it's not that bad, and it's actually a little bit funny in its absurdity.
Yeah, I think the way to pitch this is to say, if you did you like The Name of the Rose, then maybe this is the next book for you.
Right. It's got a lot less poison in it, but it's still really good.
It's like The Name of the Rose, just less poison and more smut. That's I don't know why they didn't ask us for a blurb.
I think we're just not big enough, Glenn. But
that's probably it. It's the only reason.
Yeah, it's also we didn't start this show until 10 years after this was published.
I think these are all solvable problems.
right, with our little time machine. But I think now's a good time to bow out. So that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. Let me say thank you one more time to the extremely generous Patreon supporter who commissioned this series of episodes on this story. We both had a blast reading this story. It is just, I mean, Evanson's prose is just beautiful. This story is full of this type of Swiftian satire, full of absurdities, but yet it moves along at a clip and has just really fascinating world building. So I recommend that anyone who hasn't read it do that. And I'm so glad that we had the chance to do that. And so on that note, then, I will say until next time, we greet you and say farewell.